This is the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley. We argue a lot about the proper teaching of American history in our time, what to take out, what to leave in, and how it makes students feel. Our next guest bypasses a bunch of the controversy through sheer comic invention. Alexandra Petri, I think AP History, is the author of Alexandra Petri's U.S. History, Important American Documents I Made Up. Alexandra Petri clearly could not get enough of Washington, D.C., even though she grew up there as the daughter of a Wisconsin Congress member. Her consistently funny columns run in the Washington Post and in papers around the country. Alexandra Petri published two previous books of essays, including A Field Guide to Awkward Silences. Alexandra Petri, thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Is it true you roomed with Megan Amram in college? We had her on years ago to talk about Science for Her.
Oh, yes, it is true. In fact, we just did an event in L.A., last night.
Oh, that is fun. So basically, you were on a humor path from college on, maybe even before?
Oh, exactly. And the funny thing was, it was nice meeting somebody else who was as into puns and had as high a threshold for what was groan-worthy versus what was to be greeted with celebrations. So it made it feel very normal to be constantly thinking of puns in the...
Oh, that's good. So you guys had a chance to kind of work on each other's, you know, hone each other's comedy skills, it sounds like.
Yeah, or serve as sort of a safe pun repository so that other people would only get the non-puns.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this book. Was American history just not funny enough already for you?
Well, so my favorite thing about history is looking at sort of the weird corners and all the primary documents. Like, I love that big book that they give you in high school. They're like, here's the... You know, if you read these 37 sermons, you'll understand everything you need to know about the past. And I always, my dream was to write one that was just like that, but made up. Because for me, like, one of the banner days in recent years was when they had the release of Warren G. Harding's secret papers.
Uh-huh.
And I was just like, I want more of this. 'Cause as an sort of English classics major, I feel like I wanted to go back to the roots of history, because you've got, as all the Thucydides nuts among your listeners know, like, the original historians, at least in ancient Greece, were sitting there saying, you know, when I wasn't at a speech, I would just make up words that seemed like the kind of thing that you would say on an occasion like that. And I'm like, where's this energy now? So I brought that desire to create a book of documents with that same level of like, let's just go for it. Let's make it up.
Yeah, Warren G. Harding's letters. The fact that those are true, and I should point out to listeners, there's a quiz you can take at the Washington Post about what's real and what's not that Alexandra put out. And stuff.
You know, the things that are real are just as surprising as the things that are not. And honestly, in the course of working on this book, I was always amazed by the stuff that I would find that wasn't made up. Like the time that Nikola Tesla, Elon Musk's muse and inventor of so much of the electricity, he was actually in love with a bird. Like, genuinely, he had this whole thing where he's like, I love her as a man loves a woman. And when she went out of my life, the light went out of my life. And so I didn't really have to even make up the wackiest part of that chapter, the chapter where
Nikola Tesla, yeah, it was an intervention, basically. It was just, yeah, and in PowerPoint, no less, which, you know, is appropriate to the guy who basically founded AC electricity.
Exactly. No, I think the most unrealistic element of that is the idea that he had, like, friends who were looking out for him and willing to intervene when his life took a turn. I think that's really where the inaccuracy in that section lay.
So this obviously goes all the way back to you know, the early days of people coming over from Europe to start what we came to know of as the United States. And there's actually a survey for pilgrims early on. Question three is, are you a cult? Which actually seems like a fair question in retrospect.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of the people coming over were sort of, I don't know if it's controversial, but like, they were a little odd about religion. Like, they weren't, everyone was like, oh, you know, it's really great that you're here, and we're happy that you're in England because your religious ways are so normal. That was not the energy that they were bringing. and so the survey addresses that.
Yeah, I have to admit, I did not snort out loud until page 14 in Top Toys for Puritan Parents.
Oh, yeah. Well, as a parent myself now, I do feel like now that I'm going through it, I'm like, oh, these would be choking hazards. I can't believe that, like, I was suggesting that people give their children spiders being dangled by a thread as companions for plush sinners that are flammable and vulnerable and only can be saved by grace. And, you know, that kind of exciting parental gift.
I think I laughed the hardest when I got to the difficult bake oven because, you know, nothing should be easy.
Well, exactly. Or Elmo, who delights in nothing. Don't tickle him. It's folly.
Alexandra Petri is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book of made-up documents is Alexandra Petri's U.S. History, Important American Documents I Made Up. The naming of places in the colonies, I think you nailed this. Talk about some of the guidelines for naming of places in the New World.
Oh, certainly. Well, often, like, new followed by the name of the place you just left, mm-hmm. the name of your king, but put town on the end, generic type of monarch, but with ton or stun on the end. The number of times your monarch has had sex, just put that on a whole state. Woods, but with your name on them, but put it in Latin. Just every monarch name in Latin or not in Latin, or positive or neutral name, Fort Haven, describing the place, but put new in front.
Yeah, I think you really got it there. And then the map is great because, you know, the maps, pictures, the stuff that comes along with this is really fun. You know, and then let me just give people an idea of the range of things here. There's a letter from a spider complaining about Jonathan Edwards' symbolism in Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. There's the Paul Revere poem amended to include Samuel Prescott, the guy who actually got there. And then the Hour Men, not the Minutemen. Who were the Hour Men?
Oh, the Hour Men. So hearing about the Minutemen, these, you know, civilian militias who claimed that they could be ready in a minute to get to wherever they needed to be, this always seemed made up to me, and I refused to believe in it because I don't think you can actually be ready in a minute. So the Hour Men, this is a document of the people who got ready in what seems to me to be a more reasonable frame of time, and it's the account of one of their experiences attempting to get to the Battle of Bunker Hill at the same time that everybody in the Minutemen was getting there.
I know the description of you know, approaching Bunker Hill and everybody else is walking the other direction. There's just some great stuff in here.
Well, because you sort of when you're late, you have the problem of like, well, should I even go? Like, will they be annoyed if I missed it? Because, as he puts it, like, if they're having a battle, I don't want to interrupt them in the middle of it because that'd be pretty awkward. And if the British are there, they'll still be there later. But yeah, he did ultimately decide to go.
We talked a little bit about Warren Harding and his letters to his mistress, which are kind of cringeworthy and real, not included in the book then because, you know, they're not real. They are real. But recurring throughout the book, there is something you do called 50 States of Gray. What are these sidebars about?
Oh, yeah, these are excerpts, of course, from a never-published erotic history of the United States that got sprinkled in by mistake. And they're just things like, you know, Patrick Henry saying, give it to me, liberty. Or death, one of the two. Just other, like, turns of phrase, like the Benjamin Harrison situated between two Clevelands that you never knew you needed. All of that exciting action for fans of the United States who wish that it were a little more like the 50 Shades of Grey franchise. But not too much, just dabbles of it.
Oh, yeah, and some of them are just really, really, really short, but effective for just that reason as punctuation for the other stuff in the book. So while we're on the founding of the Republic, what did Hamilton propose to make the Federalist Papers more interesting?
Oh, yeah, well, he thought it might be fun if it were more serialized because, like, why is this Publius guy? Like, why are we tuning in? You know, like, isn't if each one is sort of a discrete episode as opposed to making it something that you want to, like, there's a cliffhanger at the end of it. So actually he and Jay all had these concepts, and Jay had more of a horror sci-fi direction that he wanted to go in, but he couldn't figure his way out of the plot. So that he just had several Federalists where Publius gets stuck in a hole and is screaming. But I think it makes sense that Hamilton was thinking about this because you want to know that you're rooting for the guy and, like, why he's fighting the Articles of Confederation. And it turns out that the backstory is they murdered his family. And, you know, like, stuff like that. That's information that makes the reader want to come back and root for Publius in ways that just hearing Publius's thoughts about what makes good governance might not do.
You feel really sorry for Publius after a while because, you know, things like in Federalist 68, the mode of election of the president, Publius screams and screams.
There's many where he just screams and screams. Weirdly, originally the plan of the Federalist Papers is mostly just Publius screaming and screaming. But so you can see why they didn't go in that direction, but it's still nice to look at how it could have been.
If you're just tuning in and wondering what in God's name we're talking about, Alexandra Petri wrote Alexandra Petri's U.S. History, Important American Documents I Made Up. You can read Alexandra's regular columns in the Washington Post and often syndicated around the country as well. Let's move on in history. And, oh God, what did you do with the big women's convention at Seneca Falls?
Oh, well, I found as an avid watcher of Hallmark movies that any time a business-minded woman goes to a picturesque small town with a name like Seneca Falls, inevitably there's some sort of hunky man in a plaid button-down and a single dad who wants her to put aside big city things and come and live in the city forever. And so when the same thing happened to Elizabeth Cady Stanton upon her arrival at Seneca Falls for the convention, It wasn't a surprise. It was, you know, it was bittersweet, but it was expected. And so she discovers that maybe instead of declaring sentiments, she should be feeling sentiments. So it's a whole Hallmark movie for the price of a women's rights.
And about the same point in history, we visit Thoreau at Walden Pond, but you turned it into Where's Walden, complete with the striped shirts and everything.
Oh, yeah. No, we had an actual illustrator, Ursula Miller, who's a genius, and she took my very poor sketch of, here's the concept of a Where's Waldo, but it's all Thoreau things, and executed it so there's like a bear wandering around. It's my favorite page by far.
Well,
so radio listeners, just picture a really cool-looking Where's Waldo-type page with lots of people in striped suits, but they're all like, they look like Henry David Thoreau.
And sometimes the biggest laughs on any of these are the asterisks and other marks you put in, because there are several different kinds sometimes required to point out the things that are true, like Walden and how he got his laundry done while he was out there in the wilderness.
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite. Like, learning true facts is my favorite part of this, and it turns out his mom was actually bringing him his laundry at regular intervals so that he could be more self-sufficient. And there has been like a lot of discourse around this, and so I'm sure you'll get somebody calling in and being like, actually, like it's somewhat overblown the extent to which this laundry thing was happening, and he was, you know, there was like a larger picture there. But to me, the top line, that what made him so self-sufficient was the presence and labor of others, remains.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff. The Scarlet Letter abridged. The voice is so familiar, I couldn't quite place it.
Oh yeah, well the thing about the Scarlet Letter is I'm still mad that I was made to read the Scarlet Letter, and so I think that comes through in my effort to abridge it, because it's.
Well, you know, Hester Prynne emerges from jail, and the first thing she says is, hey, my eyes are up here, not on the A.
Yeah, please, everyone, my eyes are up here, although I guess the scarlet letter that marks my infamy is down there. And I do like how her husband comes back, and so spoiler alert for the scarlet letter. So Hester Prynne has an affair, and then her husband comes back and demands to be called Roger Chillingworth. And, you know, he's like a cool name that he just came up with, and definitely very real sounding and not at all suspicious. And Pearl, her oddly precocious, one of those. Pearl sort of belongs in a Hallmark movie in terms of the energy that she's consistently bringing through the book.
Yeah.
So I'm also mad about Pearl.
We're getting close to a break here, but I want to establish that you do literary mashups in here and pretty amazing stuff, like Walt Whitman doing My Milkshake and YMCA. And how do you get into another writer's mind so easily?
Well, in Walt Whitman's case, I just read and listened to a ton of his stuff. And fortunately, there's people who've done spoken word Walt Whitman, like remixes. So if you just go to Spotify or your music purveyor of choice, YouTube Music, whoever is sponsoring the show, and you look for Walt Whitman, there's a lot of people who are like, but what if Walt Whitman but jazz? And so I just was like listening to it and having it on in the background until I could get something that kind of approximated his rhythm. Because the way his poetic rhythm works and the way my brain works, he's so declarative and so assertive and so just striding forth boldly and sounding his barbaric yawp and whatnot, and I tend to hedge a lot more. So it did take a lot of like listening and trying to bang it into my head. So apologies to my husband who had to sit there while I was like playing Walt Whitman's spoken word, being like, isn't this cool? Aren't we learning a lot? But I guess he knew what he was getting into.
All right, I want to hear more about the creative process when we come back from a break. Alexandra Petri is our guest on The Exchange from The Washington Post and the author of Alexandra Petri's U.S. History, Important American Documents I Made Up. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in 2 minutes. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley. The guest is Alexandra Petri, who writes a humor column for The Washington Post and has also put out a couple of books of essays. The latest is one that really takes on American history itself, Alexandra Petri's U.S. History, Important American Documents I Made Up. You can just run the gamut from the Federalist Papers to the American Songbook to McCarthy's other lists. All these things appear in the book. And so, Alexandra, talk about the work this took. I mean, there's a lot of history, a lot of documents to fake, a lot of styles to copy. I mean, how much time is invested in this book?
Well, this is one of those things where I think they said about like George Lucas that like if he didn't make Star Wars a blockbuster movie, this is the sort of thing he would have done in his basement anyway, and that was sort of the energy I was bringing to the book. Like, my idea of a fun weekend is getting to read The Jungle, or Bruce Barton's 1925 classic, The Man Nobody Knows, about what if Jesus was a sexy businessman, a real best-selling book that, like, all those books that get sort of mentioned in your textbook when you're learning history for the first time that are like 1925's hottest bestseller, and of course, Upton Sinclair's groundbreaking The Jungle, and I was like, I never got the chance to actually read those. I'm going to do it. And so it was a blast to actually get through and read those. And although I somehow went into The Jungle thinking that the protagonist was going to be turned into sausage by the end of it, and I was sad that that wasn't the case, but maybe spoiler alert, I guess not meat spoiling, just regular spoiling.
Right, right, right.
In my version, he does get rendered.
Not completely. I should point out, I'll double spoil your spoil alert there. The, you know, it's not that horrible. It's just horrible enough, right?
Exactly. Yeah. He aimed for the hearts of the public and hit them in the stomach.
So it sounds like you really enjoy this, though, being able to go back and pick up on some of these major texts of American history.
Well, because I think they're very fun and goofy in ways that you wouldn't expect them to be. And I love, like, sort of being able to find these little human moments. Like, much as I hated reading Warren G. Harding's letters, I also loved getting that sort of access to what he was thinking about besides the Teapot Dome scandal. And I'm sure Alice Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's out-of-control amazing daughter, mm-hmm. She would go to parties, and as, like, her party trick, she would recite the Warren G. Harding letters. So I'm just like, I'm not alone in this. People have enjoyed dorking out about this sort of topic before.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, we talked about a mixing of styles here. So you have the Gettysburg Address as done by Aaron Sorkin. Did you watch a bit of West Wing in the day?
Yes, I may have. I may have. I had friends who were really watching a lot of West Wing, and they were like, Josh and Donna had better get together, and we've got to spend this whole sleepover making sure that they do. And I was more of like a passenger in those sleepovers. I was more of like in the driver's seat when it came to like forcing everyone to watch Lord of the Rings. That was more my, okay. Like the box set, like the one where you have all of like three physical discs and you have to like take the disc out and put another disc in because there's so much movie.
Oh, wow.
I was a lot of fun and I continue to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounds, have you lost a lot of friends over the years, Alexander?
I feel like the friends who are sort of in you, in the foxhole with you watching Lord of the Rings on three separate discs for a seventh time, they're sort of stuck with you for life.
Yeah, that's true. They have made a commitment, a complete commitment, it sounds like, yeah.
Or what feels like for life, because Return of the King just refuses to end. But, yeah.
And then they went back and they made the three other movies, too. But, you know,
let's, oh, my gosh, yeah. At that point, we, like, had independent households, and it was harder to, once everyone is able to drive themselves places as opposed to being beholden to the one friend who can, it's a lot easier to not...
Let's, here again, as with the Warren Harding letters, I mean, some of the funniest stuff is actually when the original source material is actually pretty funny, like etiquette books. You take those on. The real things can be such a scream, and it seems like you didn't have to change much to make these resonate.
No, I barely did. I feel like the recipes in the 1950s are a thing that is completely unaltered, and some of the actual recipes are wilder than, like, my concept for, like, oh, it's like a dill pickle panopticon. It's like, yeah, actually, we used to make those. And my mom's like, that sounds delicious. Why can't I have that? Or, like, aspic. There's no aspic in mine, but I've eaten it, and you shouldn't have to. But maybe I ate bad aspic. Anyway, I apologies to aspic fans among the audience, but any sort of gelatinous mass mm-hmm. that's like has to be served at a party, I'm predisposed against social gelatinous masses.
Yeah, I'm going to cross out the question about 1950s recipes. I think you've just covered that.
Ingredients, the best years of your life.
Oh, God, yeah. So, but let's talk about some of the things that actually happened in American history and certainly can be cringe-inducing even now, like the corrupt bargain of 1877 that put Rutherford Burchard Hayes in the White House. And this is several horrible U.S. history threads running through this event, the Civil War, the Electoral College, Jim Crow, which made me wonder if anger or something like it is good satire fuel.
I think always. I think when you feel rage, you can translate that into words and hopefully get other people to be as mad about it as you are. Or sometimes you just have to have the steam coming out of your head like a cartoon figure. But yeah, no. I think one of the primary things that makes people want to write satire is when you see something and you're like, well, that's just so completely wrong. And if anyone is looking at that and doesn't think that it's completely wrong, I have to see if I can do anything to open a window that will allow them to look at it and maybe see another angle of it and grasp the full horror.
Yeah, yeah. Or the ridiculousness of it on whatever level, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So that was follow up that with Nellie Bly, the famous reporter, giving a review of the mental institution on New York's Blackwell Island. This also was kind of close to reality for comfort.
Yeah, well, no, and her actual account is pretty straightforwardly what I have in there, and because her worry was that she was going to appear to be. Like, that there would be no way that they would put somebody who was as sane as she seemed to be into the mental institution. And in fact, she had the opposite problem. She was like, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get out of this. So, you know, there's a couple of moments in there when she was like, I sure hope my employer comes and picks me up, because otherwise, like, there are many women who should not be stuck here, and their only problem was that they didn't speak English. And that's, and now they're in horrible conditions, and
it was pretty amazing. Yeah, especially the slant you took on German language, but people can read that part of the book. We're talking to Alexandra Petri from the Washington Post about her latest book, Alexandra Petri's U.S. History, Important American Documents I Made Up. So let's lighten the tone a little bit. We get to Carl Sandburg's poem on Chicago, and, well, you heard saxophones that I never heard.
I'm amazed that for so long this poem was presented to people as though it was like, you know, this is a normal poem. Like, just read this poem, and it's how a poem ought to be. There's nothing strange about it. And the whole poem is him just being like, oh, Chicago, like your white teeth, sweaty, beautiful. Like, it's sort of, you want Carl Sandburg to calm down about this city. Hog butcher to the world. Fierce
city of
is a
broad
dog
shoulders.
With tongue lapping for action, cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness. Like, these are his words. It's like, oh boy. Half naked, sweating, proud to be hog butcher, toolmaker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and freight handler to the nation. So most of my section about this is just like, Carl Sandburg needs to calm down about Chicago or apply this skill to other cities. And I guess he chooses the second thing.
Yeah, and you can guess where he goes with Cincinnati.
Yeah, name is double sin.
So we touched briefly on, if you pardon the expression, touched briefly on Benjamin Harrison earlier, and this comes up actually a couple of times. What makes Benjamin Harrison such an easy target for teasing in American history?
Well, I love Benjamin Harrison in that he's the one Hoosier president, and my mom's side of the family are all proud Hoosiers, and so I had to learn a lot about Benjamin Harrison over the years. There's this double dactyl about Benjamin Harrison is like, higgledy piggledy, Benjamin Harrison, 23rd president, was, and as such, served between Cleveland and, save for this trivial idiosyncrasy, didn't do much, which doesn't actually address the full breadth of his achievements, which include things like marrying his wife's niece, but only after it was appropriate to do so, and having two opossums named Mr. Reciprocity and Mr. Protection. And no, I genuinely once appeared in a documentary about Benjamin Harrison as a talking head. They did not credit me as an expert. They credited me as an aficionado, and I think that they were correct to do so. But yeah, any chance to mention Benjamin Harrison, I am there for it.
Oh, that's excellent. Wow. Just so many colorful figures in American history. And how do you choose? I want to move on to a section called the Classic American Songbook, because it's just an amazing list. It's a list only. And I do think you need to start writing some of these songs, Alexandra. But just some of the tropes. I mean, this probably was a really long list that you've cut a bit.
Yeah, because there are so many songs and so many types of song, and one of my favorite things to listen to is like songs trying to get people to go fight in World War One, mm-hmm. which is such a specific genre of song that I feel like you could do a whole piece that's just that, where it's like, wouldn't it be a nice idea to go to Europe and fight a necessary war? And then like, we don't need to process this war, we need to Charleston now. And then like Rodgers and Hammerstein songs, which are a whole genre to themselves, and I in fact have a whole section about like, how did you put the exclamation point at the end of Oklahoma and why? But like, my girlfriend has left me for a much more fulfilling life as a trapeze artist, and maybe there's gender stuff going on there also. It was one of the classic songs mm-hmm. of the late 19th century, and you can find many of these songs, and I sure like to sail, but...
Well, the one that took me a while to process, and unfortunately this song gets stuck in my head a lot, so I'm not going to give the actual title of it, but Put Something on a Plant to Let People Know You're Taken.
Yes, Put Something on a Plant to Let People Know You're Taken. Well, I loved it when the Andrews Sisters covered that one.
Yes, of course. Let's see, I'm White But My Pelvis Will Terrify You. I Dislike Another Individual Rapper for Specific Reasons I Will Now Enumerate. I mean, there's just some. So I really, you need to start writing these songs down.
I'll have to do a book too.
Yeah. So back to the 50 States of Grey. Did these wake you up at night? I just had this vision of you going, oh, I have another one.
Yeah, I think they both kept me from falling asleep at night and would wake me up in the morning. They were accompanying me all of the time. Absolutely. Sometimes like you have an idea that comes to you in a dream and you write it down and you're like, well, this idea was no good. But sometimes the idea makes it in. And so, yeah, sometimes it's just like, here's a recipe you can do with eggs that is bad. And it's like, actually, no, this was broadly cooked in the 1950s.
Oh, yeah, 50s food. Let's get away from that one again.
No, we've got to go back to the 50s food. It's the best food.
It's amazing stuff. The people whose styles you emulated, you do Ayn Rand in here. Are there some writers whose heads you really wanted to stay out of?
I feel like the answer to that should be Ayn Rand, but I was like, let me get in there. and I think people who have like sort of interesting writing tics that are sort of easy to emulate, like Hemingway is an example of like, personally, he doesn't seem like he was a picnic, to put it mildly, but he sure hated an adverb, and I could work with that from a periodic perspective. Or like Shirley Jackson is so good and so scary and has like such a...
From The Lottery and some of the story, yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, because, yeah, The Lottery is the one that I kept saying to like my publisher, like, you know, it'd be a fun thing to do at events. We could all do the thing like in The Lottery where we'd give out little slips of paper, but at the end you'd win a fun prize instead of it being a metaphor for how communities turn on one another and like ritual can be used for violence. And they were like, please don't do that.
Yeah.
But I still think it would be a fun event idea.
Okay, well, we'll put you on the list for that one. We're just about out of time. You have an event at Powell's Books, I see, in Portland on May 8th. And I wanted to ask about the real-life events, because it kind of got in the way of the publication of the book, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was, in the sense that I genuinely forgot what year it was that the book was due. And so when it came around to be 2021, I was like, May 2021. They're like, where's the book that you owed us? And I'm like, oh, this is 2021, this year that is happening right now. And so both between like having pandemic brain and not realizing that the book was due and having a baby, yeah, several things delayed the arrival of the book.
All right, it's just so much fun to read, and don't read it all at once. You could hurt yourself. Alexandra Petri's U.S. History, Important American Documents I Made Up. Alexandra Petri, thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson
Exchange.
Thanks
for having me.
And that's it for today's exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. For all of us at JPR, have a great day.